Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Skylink satellites, which are coming courtesy of Elon Musk. Now, I'm only talking about this is because as a scientist, it's perhaps the sort of the next great unimaginable thing that would happen in the science, sort of after you plan on being dead, you know, what science would come along. And for me, I hadn't really thought about too much about what the new science will be to possibly replace optical fibers and lasers and point-to-point aspects of it. So I don't know. It's SpaceLink is the thing to replace optical fibers. And although I find the idea of sort of acknowledgement of yourself, getting yourself, your own personality caught up in a vision, sort of an anathema to me, perhaps Elon Musk is really a new type of, even better than Thomas Edison. I can't quite understand it. So he himself is not inventive, but this is a pretty amazing development. So I'll try and talk about what SpaceLink is. So SpaceLink is potentially very important, and if it gets around, it's sort of mind-blowing how you could possibly get any competition with it. It's sort of getting bound to sort of a global product and how you can have without competition competition for it. So I'll just try and say it. So before we had a whole series, like back in the day, I remember in the 70s, my dad used to occasionally receive a big trunk call via operator from London. It would take a couple of seconds. Someone would say something, there'd be a gap as the thing was amplified and put through circuits, and a whole lot of analog circuits, and finally put, and things were eventually a big major thing going out of track lines up to satellites. There'd be analog signal and a lot of noise would get into it. And then came along a couple of things. One is, I suppose, solid-state lasers and optical high-gain optical fiber and things along those lengths. And we've worked out how to produce these long continuous lenses which can snake across the planet and form an optical fiber network, multi gigahertz things. So first I wanted to describe lasers, and I'm going to use lasers in both cases. So a laser is light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. I've forgotten what the actual term for something like that is called. So what actually happens is that you get this symmetry, sort of time symmetry in, space, and essentially the only thing that can produce light, or any radio thing, is an antenna. And the antennas can have two states. They can actually have the state in which the energy is put in and it comes out into the medium, or it goes from the medium getting put back into the antenna. Now, this is so an antenna couples radiation into something, into itself, so it can actually emit and receive it. And the emission and receiving is governed by several basic things. It can be driven, or it can actually be spontaneous. So spontaneous emission means that you've got this statistical overlap that these things in the upper state will spontaneously go down to the bottom state over a period of time. That's spontaneous emission. But you can have these two symmetric things, absorption and emission, stimulated emission. This is where the actual electric field impounding creates an oscillation in the antenna, and the antenna dumps its energy into the field. So the reverse of that is there's a the energy's in the field, it's coming past, and the take up, the transfer of the energy from the energy field to the antenna is proportional to the electric field, and vice versa, the actual emission outwards is proportional to the electric field. Now, if you can actually get that electric field to build up and have a population inversion, you can have a laser. And the real, the thing which revolutionized this is solid state. So your electrons of a particular shape can act as a dipole. So your electron inside your solid state medium is basically one electron for the entire crystal. So the crystal has got one nucleus. It's got billions of nucleuses, and the electron is distributed amongst that. You can have different shapes, and you can pump it up such that there's a certain type of shape which is not reflecting. The electron itself is a wave, and the planes of nuclei act as refractive index mirrors, and so you can have it stored one end of a mirror, and then the light comes through and sweeps that radiation out as a laser pulse. So you can actually create high speed, you change your electric field in your laser, and that in one case, in the most simple case, that electric field can actually get dumped. Information of your highly changing electric field can be dumped into the laser pulse. You can modulate it. In general, what happens is that the electric field is generated in a long optical fiber. It's the nature of it. It's hard, because it's long length, it's hard to modulate. It's an optical fiber laser. I feel like that is a large beast that's hard to imprint information into it. So in general, with the optical fibers, you have the laser, the solid-state laser, and it goes into a modulator, which is this, in general, the optical fiber splits in two and recombines, and so you take half the light out from it, and you phase wobble the light. And so what happens is the light comes out of this mirror, and it will either shoot forward or shoot backwards, and you can use that to modulate it at a high speed. And the higher the speed, you can encode your information and store absolutely mind-bogglingly high amounts of information on it. So this is a pretty amazing process. And then we've developed the ability to make ultra pure optical fibers. And the way it was done is by the deposition of a fruit. That is, I actually make the optical fiber out of a pure gas. So rather than actually purifying a liquid or a slurry, I actually purify the atoms, and I make this optical fiber fruit. I actually met the person who discovered this in Corning, how to make this in Corning, and this is essentially, you can get something ultra pure by having ultra pure gases. So you can purify gases, and I think it's silicon SH4 burns with oxygen and produces this silicon dioxide glass. So the sand itself is not made into optical fiber. The sand is used to refine the silicon, which is made silane gas. And silane gas melts and forms this frit. And this frit heats up and actually forms this optical fiber tube. And so you can actually make 1,000 kilometers of optical fiber, and if you put 100 watts in, you'll get 1 watt out at the other end. And it is possible to do that because it can have very high-powered lasers. Although there's only a certain amount of power density you can put in one of these optical fibers. So what indeed happens is that they have optical fiber amplifiers as you go across these, all this beautiful, beautiful technology, optical fiber technology. And there is something very almost steampunk about it, how you can plumb the light around the place. And so we've sort of dramatically shrunk the planet that's 60 milliseconds. So let's say 60 milliseconds, it's, what is it? It's something like a 20th of a second gap. So you could possibly, if you heard it, it would be a click is the difference between New York and London. Of course, that's the sort of the killer places. So the reason is it's shrunk the place to mean that everyone has got access to huge amounts of data, and associated with this is mobile phone wireless technology, and a bit of sort of what is really equivalent to supercomputers. So essentially there's image reconstruction. So the actual communication thing is still pretty gritty. However, we've basically essentially made the computers to simplify and clarify the signals so good and so cheap that we have them everywhere. So from your not in general, your little domestic port, which takes almost no value of data whatsoever, it's not really worth having a good line to it. So it's got a pretty, most homes have a pretty shit line, and it's got this fast Fourier transform error correction signal. So there's no way, I think people would be familiar in the 90s, 56 kilobytes per second was the maximum amount of information you could get down a copper wire, but now there's sort of 30 megabits per second, or 30, or even 100 megabits per second is the amount of wire signal you can get down your copper wire. And so there's all this data correction, this beautiful plumbing of optical fibers. This is, I used to make circulators with robots, and so circulators is this beautiful, all these optical tricks you can do. Circulator operates on a polarization dependent path. The light goes through. If it goes through one way, it's one polarization, it comes back the other way, it goes through a Faraday rotator in a magnetic field to rotate the polarization. So it goes in one into a device, and rather than the light coming back out again, which is a normal thing with a mirror, and you want to route the light, it comes out a different path using a circulator. So there's all these absolute brilliant smarts and electronics just driving this. Mindless, and of course, we've got these things that the various bits of technologies come together. Now, what's happened is that Elon Musk, what I am actually doing is waiting for I'm recording a background screen for something else, so I've just decided I'll give a data on this. Elon Musk has gone and actually decided, well, we can do something which is just, it's so amazing it hurts my head. So if you can imagine the Earth as a wicker basket, covered with this wicker basket of, I think 7,000, nearly 8,000 satellites. So over your head, streaming across all the time would be, I say, 10 or so satellites which you could communicate with. And these satellites are going in about, say, 10, 20 tracks. And these tracks are sort of like a a series of crisscrossing orbits which go around, and these satellites are going around. Now, the important thing is that these are low Earth satellites. Low Earth satellites, which are precision set with a new ultra-lightweight, highly efficient micro-engine, which is the xenon or krypton iron engine. So these things take solar energy in, create an electric field, and then juice out a little bit of charge on your noble gas. The noble gas can have an electron affinity, actually stick a few electrons to it. So this is, you know, basically quantum mechanics and all coming into go. And then with those electrons stuck to it, it can have an enormous acceleration, then stripped and neutralized. This is an iron engine. And so these iron engines are extremely lightweight. They've got a huge thrust to power weight ratio. It's using the energy of the sun, so these engines can actually sit and just drive these satellites. So these satellites barely get up, and then they're pushed up to around 400 kilometers. Now, 400 kilometers is much closer to the Earth. This is almost an aircraft distance, and it means that basically your node is, rather than to the ground to the next section, your node is floating above you a few hundred kilometers an hour at high speed. And of course the entire idea is, how do you track, how do you get something to move? And the entire idea is to have these antennas where you can control, these big flat antennas where you can control the phase of things, and you can actually recreate an antenna pointing at a different direction by controlling the phase. So you can, at high speed, as fast as you can switch the direction of your antenna. And these satellites are just above the ground, so it takes no time to get there. The typical thing is to use geostationary satellite. So this is a satellite sitting out at 64,000 kilometres. Roughly, I've got maybe 30,000 kilometres. I can't really remember. I'll have to see if I can remember. So these have an orbital period the same as the orbital period of the Earth. So these takes 24 hours to do a first around. So they, in effect, track the sun. They stay in the same position on Earth. So I could erect an antenna. I could erect an antenna way this far out, and it would be have an actual orbital period for sticking up there. But these antennas take a good, you've got a good second latency. So even still, with these things are used, they tend to use the satellites. People, you see newscasters listening, and the Sydney to London, there's that still a good tick-tock. There's a noticeable half-second delay where they're listening for a while, and it comes in, they're listening to what's said, and then they respond, and it looks, even though they're responding half a second, it's a full second delay. And this is not true with these low latency satellites, which are just skimming above Earth. And you've got 7,000 of these, and these have to convert the information into laser pulses and fire the laser pulse over a huge distance. And this is over several hundred kilometres. And to actually, in space, it's no problem getting that distance. It's nice. There's no absorption. So the interesting thing is that you have to, if you get an optical fibre laser, it's only a few millimetre, the most, away from your optical fibre before the beam diverges up, so it's unusable. So you've got diffraction limiting. A directional limiting, I don't know whether what the fraction of it. The diffraction limiting is the width, the acuity with which you see things. So one of the things is that although the exception to this is spiders and I suppose dragonflies, if you want good precision, you need actually a big eye, especially at night. So owls have big eyes and eagles have big eyes, things which hunt and want to see at high accuracy. So you need actually a bigish soup plate size laser to actually go 100 kilometers. Now, to get a soup plate size laser, because that will it'll be focused down and then beam up. So this is to have a chance of, say, by the time it gets across, diffraction limited after 10 kilometers, I would say after 100 kilometers, just off the top of my head, depending on what wavelength they're doing at, it would be a meter or so across, or meter, 10 meters across, which is okay, because you don't want extremely high precision where all your energy is in one point. You've got lots of energy to play around with, so it's got to be within the envelope. Your laser has to be the envelope. So the big question is, how do you get a laser the size of a soup plate producing kilowatts of energy and with the accuracy of the beam? How does it operate? Well, the critical way to do it is, so not just one laser, but a VCSEL. So this is essentially where you want the laser pulse coming out, but you control the phase, and power of the laser, such that it's got a Gaussian profile and Gaussian phase across it. And so with that phase, it will actually be already beam expanded. And they have VCSELs. This is sort of mini microscopic lasers with huge diffraction properties, but you've got a whole silicon wafer of these lasers, and you power them all at the same time, and they act as a single, coming out as a single laser beam. So you're going to get basically a plate of glass to produce a powerful laser beam, and similarly to have detectors similar to this. So you can have on each of these satellites, I think it's four or five of these big plate lasers. So this is just, it's achingly sort of just, you know, it's painful to think about the huge amount of technology in these lasers. They've got the kryptonite engines, they've got these very small disc gyroscopes which correct their orientation. And this is one of the things I don't think people get used to in space. They're used to things moving around, a bit like the Battle of Britain, things moving around smoothly. But they've got this set of gyroscopes in them, and so these things can direct and turn with just incredible precision. And it's some of this stuff that you like, it's seeing some of this stuff is just eye-wateringly complex. Like seeing for me, building robots and seeing the robots operate so well. This is just the entire thing is that when you see a Gothic cathedral built that's 100 years and artisans working hundreds of years, and the artisan may live and die, that most of them might walk on two Gothic cathedrals, you know, one where they learn a bit and the other where it's starting up and their skill goes, and their skill only goes into one or two cathedrals. Now what's happening is that the engineering skill is collating together. Things are being published, things are being put into computers, techniques, companies and stuff like that, and the skill is coming across, and we've got this enormous technology. So we've got these satellites, and I think they cost something like $300,000 each, sort of like, it's eye-wateringly cheap. And these satellites aren't going very high, and they're mass produced. So in a rocket puts up 60 at a time, and the rocket itself is one of these Falcon X's. And so the rocket goes up, and then it lands again. And it lands again due to absolute software computation. It's not this hit and miss. It's the type of stuff which, you know, no country is ever going to get up. And it's such a technological gap the US has ahead of other countries. We is sort of like this, like a hill tribe coming up against the Roman Empire. It's sort of something like that. You can dislike it and stuff like that. The technology is so far in advance. So these satellites go up there, and they basically have this amazing technology. And of course, you've got, you know, just an eye-watering quantity of them, and they can maneuver. And you know, you can imagine just computer programs. It's just another Excel spreadsheet. You just have 7,000 of these things going around, and they've got their lasers on them, and obviously they can shoot their message to different satellites ahead, four and ahead, because there's a big string that looks like a road. It's a belt of 20 roads. Each road has got 60 satellites just beaming across, and you can shoot, you can do your partner above and below, and then you can cross to the road, come across. Now, what's sort of just, you know, just, I can't, it's just almost too much, is that you can actually, this flat plate laser, you can actually direct where that laser fires. I do know one old friend of mine who's working on how this operates. It's just, so I've got a flat plate, and I can direct where my laser goes from that plate by changing the phase, because each, not just one laser, there are millions, I dare say millions of lasers on top, and you can change the phase at which they produce, introduce a phase shift and a voltage across it. And so just by setting a voltage, you can point this laser at high speed and track onto another satellite. So what happens is that your information comes up, and it has to, what happens is it goes up to the links to the satellite, and then converted to a laser pulse. The laser pulse then hits a detector, which then powers another laser, and so it can just something beyond what I can possibly understand. Now, the aim of this is sort of like twofold. Well, it's going to be hard to understand. One is to hit the, like, there's two things that I say I'm trying to work out what's going on. One is for low latency running of the stock exchange, and sort of it's this, there's a premium market, and the premium market will go to the fastest technology. So, like, it's not something which is graded. If you've got something 1 second or 10 seconds, it's not going to matter. But if you are in competition, your competition goes to the winner. So it's sort of like the difference between little athletes and Olympic sports. There's only one gold medal, and it means that the people who get it and have the most powerful computers either side will pay all this additional money because they'll have the edge. Look, you know, philosophically, my question is that given a true value, ethical decision, how can you have millisecond ethics? I myself really think perhaps the best thing that the human race could do is declare that the United States and everyone is one, have some sort of Nazi state coming in, that everywhere else on the earth is always one, it was 1 second away. So, and have a sort of universal sort of clock that the data is invisible for 1 second. Therefore, we don't have to build all this technology. We can just declare that no one has an advantage. It's an even thing that I have a nodule, and when I pour information in, that information is instantaneously available around the earth. And so, let's say half a second later, or something, or a hundredth of a second later. So, a tenth of a second later. Okay, so that's reasonable. And through all the, and so the Earth's on a level playing field, and no one can get above it. I'll do that because I don't think we understand the human race of how we're giving technological advantages to these people, which are giving a few milliseconds. That's essentially, people want to give, you know, in a market crash, you want to sell quickly or do your algorithms quicker than your opposition. I just think we've really lost the plot doing it. And then the idea is that the optical fiber rollout around the world is going to rich countries, and it's too slow to diffuse to the poorer countries. I just find that an extraordinary point of view or realization in that if you're given all of world history, if you that's for 2 million years ago, where someone would think about something and sing a song and be a minstrel and be able to get their concept to go on a boat to another island where the minstrel would, depending on their thing, would sing the idea and people would relate to it. This sort of slowness, and these villages would eke out their life without knowing about the bigger world. Their world would actually be significant there, and I don't know. I just sort of think falling in love back then, you know, that the woman in the next village would be, well, I don't know, what your mind would think. I don't think people would think in these broad terms. There's sort of like this sort of peak of humor, romance, the Renaissance, that type of thing, where you sort of had enough to think of big, but your world was small. And now I think people think small, but their world is big. I can't quite say. It's just, like, for me, the amount of images of ideal women and products and wealth, and it's this sort of addictive thing which sort of pulls us into old age. But then we go through into the old age and you still see people who are incredibly beautiful or incredibly, you know, aesthetic, and you realize that that person would be sympathetic to you as you'd be sort of like a sloth or something which is cute and adorable, but sort of not in their league. It's sort of like there's this thing which attracts us forward, but we sort of pass through the peak of life more quickly, more certainly, but we really don't know what to do on the other side of it. So I'm very, I suppose, judgmental about, you know, there's something eye-watering about the pace, and there is pace for hope, sort of the amount of solar cells coming out, sort of there's all these things come along. There's all this great technology coming up, but each time, as every time we turn around to see something we've done good, we look over our shoulder, and there are just fewer animals, fewer species, fewer areas of land standing there, and more people who have seen opportunity as an opportunity for themselves, and carving out their larger little section of an ever shrinking pie going across. So I don't know. There's, you know, I can't describe. I wouldn't for one moment think that we should reduce the rate at which we do computing and genetics and understanding. It's just some aspects, I think, for if people want to, well, I think the sort of contradiction is, for all our wealth, what do we produce? We produce a cruise ship. These huge eyesores, a testament to technology, that these things no longer have any feeling of the sea. You know, there's no roughness of the sea to it, that they are visually unstable. Like if you showed someone from the time of Captain Cook a picture of a cruise ship, they would go, well, that just cannot work. You know, how on earth does that work? How do you actually get something far taller? You know, any wind would blow that over. It would be incredible thing to see. So it seems to be that we're going forward, but we're going forward living off excess. But it's a beautiful thing to see how much farther forward we can go. I'll go in. I should be able to produce the end of this for you. Thanks a lot for listening. This is SpaceLink, a web of ultra cheap satellites, mass produced, redefining life. If it works, it's just something to almost rewrite history. It's something at the level of, I don't know, the invention of the car. It's sort of, you know, how do you explain this after, say, Napoleon's conquest, the Marco Polo, all these great journeys of exploration and conquest. This is sort of a conquest man has never seen before, this SpaceLink stuff. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.